Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Transportation Finance and Policy Division for this Thursday, March 14th. I'm Frank Hornstein, the chair. Welcome. We just have a few bills to get through before deadline. We'll do our best to do it in our time allotted, but if not, we'll be reconvening in this room 15 minutes after session. So we will be moving things around in terms of the agenda to accommodate various members' needs. We have lots of committees meeting simultaneously and votes happening. So if you see someone coming up who doesn't look like Representative Hornstein, the first bill on the agenda, it's for that reason we're accommodating Representative Stevenson. So welcome to the committee, and of course we don't have a quorum, but once we do, we will move your bill to Ways and Means. So please state your name for the record and talk to us a little about House File 1755.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Zach Stevenson, and I'm here today to talk to you about 1755, which is a very simple and straightforward bill that's designed to help us tackle the ongoing climate crisis that we are facing in the world today. As I think members of the committee are probably aware, the transportation sector is now the largest emitter of carbon in the state of Minnesota. And so what this bill does is it allows us to try as a government to reduce the amount of carbon that we are emitting through the utilization of our bus fleet in the operated by Met Council and specifically Metro Transit. The bill has an appropriation in it, but the appropriation is from the renewable development account, and so that will be handled in a different finance committee. But the policy basis here is that it restricts Met Transit's ability to buy diesel buses until the appropriation in Section 2 is used up to spend on the differential between the cost of a diesel bus and the cost of an electric bus. I do want to note that I had some feedback actually earlier today from Metro Council. They want a slight tweak in the language that we weren't able to accommodate in advance of this hearing, but I do intend to fix just basically substituting Metro Transit for Metropolitan Council in the language here so that we're clear that we're talking about the buses and the Metro Transit fee and not some of the other vehicles that the Metropolitan Council owns and operates. So that's the basic gist of the bill. I have one testifier, I believe, who would like to speak to the bill, if the chair.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. So just to your last point, did you, at the appropriate time, perhaps after we've heard testimony, did you want to make an oral amendment to that change?
You know, if the chair is inclined to accept an oral amendment, that's fine. Otherwise, this does have another committee stop, and we could fix it at the next committee. But
okay.
It's
well, I defer to you, sir. I mean, it's if it relates to transportation, it would be appropriate to do it here. We can revisit that after your testifier. And members, just a quick announcement. I know we had a few folks come late. We are going to be sort of moving things around in the agenda to accommodate members' other committees, and so that's why we're having Representative Stevenson do his bill a little bit out of order, and our motion was to move this to Ways and Means. And one other announcement, Ms. Stephen wants to remind everybody to keep, you know, if we have to come back this evening, keep the bills that we haven't heard yet in your folder so that they don't get lost. So anyway, we do now have a quorum, we'll wait for see if when Representative Petersburg comes, we can do the minutes, but at least we can move this bill out of committee now if we have the opportunity. So welcome to the committee. You've had a very busy day. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brendan Jordan with the Great Plains Institute. I represent Drive Electric Minnesota. You have a busy agenda today. I will be brief. Drive Electric Minnesota is supportive of electric transportation and its benefits and making sure that they're available to all Minnesotans, whether they drive personal vehicles or whether they bike on an e-bike or whether they take public transportation. I think this we are supportive of this bill. I think that offering electric bus transportation will be a very high quality of transportation. silent operation, zero emissions, and really will really be a premium option for users of public transportation. So Drive Electric Minnesota is supportive of this bill, and a lot of our members are involved in various ways in working with Metro Transit to deploy this system and the charging and all the aspects of making this a success for the state.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Appreciate the a couple of questions. Great. Let's do Representative Torkelson, then Representative Runbeck.
Well, thank you. An interesting proposal. Why do you feel the Renewable Development Fund is the appropriate resource for this?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if, I think that the answer to that question is that the Renewable Development Fund is developed in order to support the advancement of renewable energy, and there's a close compatibility with electric vehicles, particularly electric buses. It allows us to better take advantage of peak load times on, for example, solar equipment, because these vehicles typically charge sort of off-peak hours. So it's a load balancing issue that is really helpful, and that's a good reason to use the RDA for this one.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but solar energy and off-peak hours don't match up very well from what I know about it.
I shouldn't have said solar. I should have said wind. But I misspoke. But I think the general drift is that it is a load management issue. It helps with.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've been looking at this electric bus issue in some detail over the last few weeks, and the story we've gotten up to this point is that these electric buses will virtually pay for themselves because they are so much cheaper to operate and maintain, even though they're more costly at the get-go, that over time the payback is significant. So are you going to refund the Renewable Development Fund as these electric buses pay for themselves?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, there's no refund in the bill.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your answer.
There's no refund in the bill, no.
So
Representative Torkelson.
Is the argument then that these electric buses are much more expensive than you thought they were to operate and own?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, that's not my argument. I think, as you noted, there's a larger upfront cost for the bill. There are savings over time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would argue that this is really not an appropriate use of the Renewable Development Fund. It's really not what it was meant for. If electric buses are the way to go, there's should be other ways to fund them rather than use this important fund for that particular purpose, in my opinion, Mr. Chair. I'm sure others have questions.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck was next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the Renewable Development Fund, I believe, is Xcel Energy's fund, and they have an advisory board that would weigh in and certainly be making stating approval of how the money's being spent. And has that advisory board weighed in on this?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbick, I am not aware of if the advisory board has weighed in on that question. I don't know how much discussion the chair wants to have about the financing mechanism of this as opposed to the policy mechanism.
I'd give the committee some latitude, but Section 1 is the most direct transportation related, but I think we can entertain some conversation about the RDF, but Section 1 is really the transportation piece.
Perhaps someone from Excel would be here and could comment. It just seems like a bit of a takings, and I don't think we do that around here, so I'd appreciate any comments.
Representative Elkins, hold on just one sec. Is there anyone from Excel or even the utility industry in general, electric utilities, munis, co-ops, investor-owned utilities? Okay, I'm sorry, Representative Runbeck. They have been coming to the Energy Committee, but not here, apparently. So, Representative Runbeck, did you want to have a follow-up question?
I don't. I didn't think we were satisfied that we had enough out of electric buses at this point. Even the range is only 100 miles, and apparently that is even reduced if they're going to be using heaters and if they have to use air conditioning. the range is reduced substantially from that. So, you know, it seems odd that we would be moving ahead without much, without having them meet, you know, the goals really of what we need for transportation.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. Representative Elkins, I saw your hand up.
Yes.
And
thank you,
speak on the mic.
Yep. I'm learning that. what I can say about this that I know is that that Metro Transit and Xcel Energy has talked about this extensively, and that Xcel Energy does support this because the bulk of the usage for the charging would be overnight using their off-peak base load. And would be at reduced rates. And I don't know where the 100-mile range came from. I don't know that we know what it will be for the first round of buses yet. That's why the reason why Metro Transit is only buying six of them is to find out what the performance characteristics are, especially related to range and battery performance. But I am quite confident in stating that the Metro Transit and Xcel Energy have discussed this extensively, and that Xcel does support this program.
Thank you, and I would echo that. You know, I sit on the Energy and Climate Committee and or Division, and we've had a lot of conversation about electric vehicles, electric infrastructure for transportation there, and I think all the utilities, investor-owned or otherwise, have spoken at various times on the record in general support of electrification. So, you know, in terms of a position, I think we can confidently say that, you know, they would be at least, you know, if not supportive of this bill, supportive of the concept. So, is there any, and again, for those who came late, we are taking things in order of the availability of authors today. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know,
Representative Petersburg.
The support for the concept, I assume you're speaking of the concept of electric buses. The concept we're talking about here is the concept of whether or not it's appropriate to use the Renewable Development Fund for the resource for this. What percentage of Xcel's service area will be served by these electric buses?
Stevenson. Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I believe there is I couldn't give you a specific number, but there's very broad overlap between the service areas of Metro Transit and the service areas of Xcel Energy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. So these electric buses are going to be used throughout the Metro buses, Met Council's bus service area?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I don't think there's anything in the bill that specifies exactly where the buses would be used, but they would be used in Metro Transit's territory, presumably.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. We've heard testimony and proposals at other times that these buses would be used in a very specific and rather restricted area, and apparently that's not what you're hearing. So I don't see any information here that actually supports the use of the RDF. Do you have letters or testimony regarding the use of the RDF for this purpose?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, again, that is a question that we'll be discussing in detail in front of the Energy Committee, which Alec has jurisdiction over the RDA.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'd request a roll call on the bill.
Okay. We still have some additional discussion. Representative Petersburg, Runbeck, and I think Elkins. And Koznick, I'm sorry. Koznick after Petersburg, then Runbeck. Okay, good.
This is just a clarifying question. I just want to make sure I understand the language on 1.17 through 1.20, where it says any funds remaining from this appropriation that are insufficient to fully fund the incremental cost of purchasing electric bus will revert back. Is that saying that if you can't fund a full bus but can only fund half a bus, that half a bus difference is going back to the account, or what does that mean? And I don't know if somebody else can explain that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevenson, do you feel comfortable explaining that, or do you have others that might be?
No, available? Mr. Chair, I would agree with that interpretation, that it's if there's incremental costs left over, that they revert back to the RDA at the end.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, one follow-up.
Sure, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know where this bill is in the Senate and what it's doing over there?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, I understand the bill. I have spoken to a senator about carrying the bill in the Senate, and I believe he has introduced it. I would have to double-check, but I believe that is accurate.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an interesting topic, and obviously you got a little few questions to iron out here. We had met at the Minneapolis North High School and talked about the other electric bus bills, and I think Representative Elkins, my memory was clear. We were trying to determine the life, how long a bus lives, basically a useful life of a bus, and I think it was about 12 or 14 years, if I remember correctly. And the break-even point, I thought, was about 12 years, so I'm not sure if we can get some clarification, because then it doesn't seem like we're really getting much farther other than maybe reduce pollution. But we're not, you know, we're spending twice as much money for these buses and not really getting any additional extra useful life out of the buses. If that was, that was kind of my understanding. So if the author has any clarification on that, I'd be interested in hearing what the author's opinions are or the thoughts are on that.
Representative Stevenson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would first say that I think that the pollution issue is really significant and is justifiable on its own. But I do think Mr. Jordan has some information about that, as well as about the range issues that were raised earlier.
And just what, as I recall, that was a very good recollection, and I think you're accurate. There was some discussion also about reduced operations and maintenance costs. So that would have to be factored into the savings here, but. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Koznick, addressing the lifespan issue, what I've heard, I'm not a bus manufacturer, so it would be great for the committee to hear from one, but what they have told me is they expect most of the components of the bus to actually last much longer than the drivetrain of a diesel bus. It just has far fewer moving parts. The thing that will need to be replaced is the batteries. But at some point in the life of the bus, you'll have a battery replacement. And there's a lot of discussion about potential second life uses for those batteries. So they may have some value as a stationary storage application providing electric grid services. So the other question that came up earlier was on range, and there was a point made about limited range for buses. What I would say about that, Mr. Chair, is there are a wide variety of ranges available. I've seen buses with ranges up to 400 miles and more. It really depends on the size of the battery pack. And I know that there's a very careful planning discussion going on between Xcel Energy and Metro Transit to plan the charging of the buses and make sure that the battery pack is the appropriate size for the route where the bus will be used, just to make sure that the range is sufficient. But the range is a customizable feature with these buses. They can develop a bus with the right size battery pack for the range they need for its duty cycle.
And just briefly, Mr. Chair, I know that there's other members with more questions. You know, so it seems like, you know, we can argue about the use of where the money comes from, which I, you know, from the side of the table, it sounds like a very good question to examine, rather the renewable development account. But overall, you know, we're taking a look at increasing the cost of a single bus by double to nearly $1 million from our previous committee hearing. So I think that's an issue. To the author, is there funds available in here? I don't really see it, but I was just kind of briefing through it. But I don't seem to find money for additional charging stations and where that expense is going to come from.
Representative Stevenson.
Chair, Representative Koznick, no, there's no money for that in this bill. This bill funds the differential between the diesel bus and the electric bus.
Well, Mr. Chair, then I might suggest that the author amend and add even more money to show the true cost that there's even more money that needs to be allocated to operate a bus so that it can actually go somewhere.
Representative Runbeck?
I'm fine, thank you.
Okay, Representative Elkins?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The question was asked earlier about where will these buses be used. The original first six buses for the trial will be used on the C-Line arterial rapid transit busway in from North Minneapolis into downtown. But I know that Metro Transit's plans are to, you know, once we've taken the learnings from the initial trial to deploy these vehicles, you know, widely throughout the region with the final, you know, configuration of the buses that they actually purchase being based on what's learned during the initial trial, such that they do have sufficient range.
Thank you for that clarification. Is there any further discussion? We do have a roll call coming. Okay, well, do you have any final words for the committee, Representative Stevenson?
Mr. Chair, I know you have a very packed agenda today, so.
Actually, sorry, we do, but we had some initial discussion of an oral amendment, and would you want to do that here or wait to the Energy Committee? It's really your call.
I Mr. Chair, if the committee is inclined, the oral amendment, I think that the that I was informed by Metro Transit Metropolitan Council is to just change on line 1.7 Metropolitan Council to Metro Transit, just to clarify that it's
okay.
The buses of Metro Transit, not vehicles.
Mr.
Operated.
Burris, do you want to repeat that oral amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, I had conferred with Judge Chetman briefly after discussion of this. I do have a recommendation for a slightly different approach on the oral amendment.
Okay. Certainly. You're okay with that, Representative Stevenson? Okay.
Yeah.
Always defer to Mr. Burris on these matters.
Yeah.
Mr. Burris.
So for oral amendment, could be page 1, line 7, after council, insert 4 Metro Transit bus service. And that would that approach would provide for some possible flexibility in where the procurement would actually take place and specify that it would be for the Metro Transit bus system.
Okay, is everyone clear on this? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as I'm reading the bill here, do we need to do anything with the where it says Metropolitan Council on 1.16?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I don't think so, because the appropriation would still be to the council, and this
it's just the bubble
the oral would specify what the purposes are of allowed use of the funds.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we are then ready to vote on the oral amendment on line 1.7, again, after Met Council for Metro Transit Bus Services.
Mr. Chair, did anyone move the amendment?
Oh, sorry. I move this oral amendment, author's oral amendment. Sorry, thank you for that. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. So the bill as amended is before us. And now, any concluding comments, Representative Stevenson?
And thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, I know you have a very packed agenda, so I'd say that this is an important step forward as we try to combat climate change and encourage electronic transportation. So I'd ask for the committee's support.
Thank you. So I will I'm renewing my motion to send House File 1755 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee, and we have a roll call on the bill as amended. Ms. Stevens.
Hornstein?
Yes.
Tabke?
Yes.
Torkelson?
No.
Bernardi?
Yes.
Elkins?
Yes.
Hausman?
Yes.
Heinrich?
No.
Cagle?
Yes.
Kosnick?
No.
Mason?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
O'Driscoll? Petersburg?
No.
Richardson?
Yes.
Runbeck?
No.
West is absent. Wolgamott?
Yes.
Joachim?
Yes.
There being 11 ayes and 5 nays, the bill is referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you very much for your bill and for your testimony, and we appreciate your I believe your first appearance before the Transportation Committee. No, you were here another time.
Yeah.
That's right.
But,
okay.
But thank you very much for your flexibility.
Yeah,
thank you.
All right. And again, on the topic of flexibility, we are going to now take Representative Eklund's bills. Do you want to do House File 253 first? And I will move that House File 253 be referred to the General Register. And, you know, Representative Eklund, we had a conversation about range anxiety when we were dealing with electric vehicles, and I have to do the customary joke that that does not apply to encounters with Iron Range legislators, just to be clear. But welcome to the committee, and please brief us on House File 253.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I kind of like the idea of electric vehicles, but we'll just leave it at that. All right, Mr. Chairman and members, a large wood products company has been considering expanding operations to include a production facility in northeastern Minnesota. The company has acquired property south of Cook, the former Ainsworth and Potlatch plant in Elango. They currently own and operate a facility in Minnesota. That facility is in northern Minnesota also. Over the last few years, we have worked to encourage this company to expand in Minnesota. Although the project has not come to a fruition, we have maintained regular communication so that we are ready to move forward with them should the time arise to do so. Current state law allows for permits to be granted to certain three-unit trucks that meet the requirements prescribed in the state as long as they are operating between Grand Rapids and the Port of Duluth along the major highway systems number 2, 53, and 169. These trucks are important to industry in northern Minnesota. This bill, House File 253, proposes a minor change to the existing law by adding another contiguous piece of Highway 53 to the permitted area. This piece of Highway 53 runs by the property that should be used, that could be used in the company's expansion. A small step of expanding the permitting authority to this stretch of highway will be helpful as we work to bring jobs to northeast Minnesota. And part of the reason for bringing this bill, Mr. Chairman and members, is we do have rail adjacent to this property, but sometimes getting the railroad to agree to stop is a different animal, and so we're asking for this exemption for this stretch of road for moving product on the highway. It'll benefit not only this potential expansion but also the paper mill in International Falls. And currently, right now, the exemptions that were made on Highway 169, about 33% of Blandon's product is moved with these three-unit vehicles on that stretch, so it's been very effective. And Blandon is in the same boat as some of these other ones with the captive rail service. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll ask or entertain any questions.
Their discussion, I remember, I think I see Representative Solberg here, and I think we did something similar a number of years ago, and that worked out. So.
Mr. Chairman, that was for the Blandon part that I talked about on Highway 169, Highway 2.
Do you have an amendment to this bill at all, or just
no.
Okay? All right. All right. Is there a discussion, Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eklund. I'm not super familiar with these routes, and one of our concerns with heavier trucks, of course, is always bridges. While we can spread the weight out over many tires to reduce per axle weight on the road, when it comes to a bridge, the whole truck can be on the bridge at one time. Are the bridges along this route in good repair and in adequate shape to handle these heavier loads?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, I've talked to Dwayne Hill, the highway district engineer from NDOT, and all the bridges on this stretch have been replaced, so they can handle the 10-ton capability.
President Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other issue with longer trucks, of course, is safety of our other users of the road who are not used to encountering these lengthy vehicles. Have you spoken with Highway Patrol or anyone else about running these longer trucks over longer routes?
Representative Eklund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, no, I haven't. I was assuming since it was working fine on shipping product out of the Blandon Mill in Grand Rapids that DOT would have, or Highway Patrol would have had something to say about it if they didn't like this bill.
They're here, but I don't see them advancing to the testifying table. So is there further discussion, Representative Runbeck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Eklund, so Truck Highway 53, could you just refresh us, is this International Falls then all the way to the Port of Duluth?
Representative Eklund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, yes, that's correct.
Okay, and Mr. Chair,
Representative Runbeck.
This is strictly logs, logging, or are there other products being hauled as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, this is for hauling finished product. The logging trucks would be are what we have right now. They come in either 100-inch or tree length, and I believe that this expansion that we're looking at, they'll be mostly taking 100-inch, so it'll be on the smaller trucks.
Good. Thank you.
Members, is there any further discussion to House File 253? Representative Eklund, did you have any concluding comments for the committee?
I just thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, members, and I think this bill will help the forest products industry in northern Minnesota.
Okay. The motion is before us to have House File 253 referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you. You're on your way to the floor. And while you're here, should we take House File 1649 as well?
That would work for me, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Okay. And this is the one that has the amendment. So allow the members a little time to go through their folders, and then we can discuss the amendment. I assume this is just one of these amendments to get the bill into the shape you'd like it considered.
That is correct, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Well, why don't we do that first then? You wanted to explain that's the A1 amendment, members. The A1 amendment.
All right, Mr. Chair, thank you. The A1 amendment on line 1.2 and 1.3, it'll just after the period. Well, you guys can read the amendment, but a third-party testing program may be reimbursed by the tested driver's school, district, or company. So what this bill, this is just going to help with what we're trying to do with this bill for small companies or school districts or such that cannot afford to have their own testing program, but they know that they'll have to pay to have their drivers tested at a third-party spot.
I don't remember if I moved House File 1649 to the General Register, but that's the motion. Is there discussion to the A1 amendment? Okay. To the A1, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. We have House File 1641 as amended before us. It is the version that the author would like us to consider the bill in. You can proceed, Representative Eklund. I see you've got a couple folks here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1649 allows for a private bus company that employs a third-party tester to enter into an agreement with another private bus company that does not employ third-party testers to administer the state-required licensure driving test to the company's driving candidates. Key points of the bill and the issues addressed: under Department of Public Safety rules, a person applying for a school bus driver endorsement can have the final driving exam administered at a state testing site or by a third-party tester certified and regulated by the Department of Public Safety and employed by a school district or a private company. A third-party tester employed by a school district can test applicant drivers within the school district and within other school districts. A third-party tester employed by a private company can only test a candidate drivers applying to work at that specific company. The third-party tests are required to test at least 12 candidates a year in order to maintain their tester status. Many small private companies do not have enough demand to maintain an on-staff third-party tester. Currently, the wait time to take a driving test at a state facility is up to 3 months. The process from when a driver applies at a bus company to drive and when they can be on the road as a licensed driver can take as little as 14 days. Because of the delay in getting the drivers before a state examiner, many driver applicants walk away after waiting 4 weeks, 6 weeks, sometimes 8 weeks to get an exam. In our district, bus drivers in International Falls and Grand Marais need to drive to Grand Rapids, Virginia, or Duluth to take the exam. Many times they need to come to the metro just to find an exam opening. We currently have a driver shortage in every school district, with some needing more than 100 additional drivers. We can't afford to let potential drivers walk away simply because they can't get scheduled for a state exam. Expanding the third-party examiner program will allow drivers access to the testing they need to become licensed school bus drivers. And because the third-party tester program is overseen by the Department of Public Safety, it is held to the same standards as the state testing facilities. I have two testifiers, Mr. Chairman, and I can turn that over to them at this time if that's possible.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in House File 1649. My name is Scott McMahon, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. We represent the 130 private bus companies that contract with school districts across Minnesota to safely transport students to and from school, sporting events, and school activities. We employ over 5,000 bus drivers. Minnesota faces a serious bus driver shortage. Every school district in the state faces the challenge, with some experiencing more than 100 drivers missing. But we know there are multiple causes of the shortfall. One cause that we experience all too often in our industry is the delay in the process it takes the school bus driver candidate to get his or her bus license. I don't want to repeat a lot of the things that Representative Eklund mentioned in his intro, so I will skip over a few things here. But we have a process laid out where a driver can get from the time they come into a bus company to being on the bus should take 14 to 30 days. We are all too frequently running into situations where it's taking us 30, 60, 90, 120 days to get them on the road. During that time, you can imagine they find other jobs and they walk away. The process isn't helping us fill the tremendous shortage that we do have in the industry. There is an alternative to this process, this third-party tester process. The third-party tester is employed either by the school district or by the private company, and they are allowed to test the candidates, and they're behind the wheel test, which is the final process. I should state that the process the driver goes through includes. Let me see if I can find it here. They need to pass within that 14-day time period to pass a physical, a drug test, a background test, a knowledge test. They need to hold a commercial learner's permit for 14 days, complete behind-the-wheel training, and then the final step is the state-issued test. What we're asking is to expand what's allowed for the third-party testing so that we can get this last step of the process done for the drivers and get them on the road more quickly. The bill allows for the private bus companies to enter into agreements, which must be approved by the Department of Public Safety, to allow the company with a third-party tester to test driver candidates from a company that does not employ a third-party tester. It also allows the company or school district providing the testing to be reimbursed by the company of the driver, not by the driver, but by the company who is hiring the driver for the expenses of administering that test. We know this won't solve the bus driver shortage, but we know that this will help tremendously in helping us get high quality and safe drivers on the road, helping our schools, our families, and our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McMahon. Are there questions for Mr. McMahon? Appreciate your coming down and your testimony. And Mr. Meyer?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, fellow members. My name is Paul Meyer. I am a general manager of Hutchinson Bus Lines in Hutchinson, Minnesota. I'm just here to state recently we had a driver come in, we'll call him Steve. He came in December 17th. We had all his applications, everything filled out, all the paperwork done. He went and took his four written exams to become a school bus driver. Within a week's time, he was ready to go. We had his criminal background check. While we were waiting for that took approximately 14 days, and we were going through his training at that time, just the pre-trip training that's required of a school bus driver. And once we got the criminal background check back, we got him behind the wheel, started him training. It was obvious he was going to be ready in very short order. We finally got a date scheduled that was 3.5 weeks out. So in the meantime, I kept him driving on vans, riding along with other school bus drivers to get the feel of how to handle the kids and how to handle the bus in different situations. There was about a week lapse where I did not hear from him at all. I called him on a Friday, and he said, well, this last week, he said, I couldn't wait any longer. He went and applied at 3M, which is a big company in Hutchinson, applied probably 25% of the town, that he applied over there, had an interview and got hired in 4 days' time. So I lost a potential bus driver in that short period while he was waiting to become a driver. I just wanted to emphasize that with a third-party tester, we probably could have called another company and got in with somebody else. It would have eliminated that situation for me. Now we have to start all over. We lost about $450 getting him trained in that we paid for and that were our expenses at that time, and now we're out that. And granted, that's part of doing business, but I think the third-party tester would help eliminate that situation.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Are there questions for Mr. Meyer? Okay. I appreciate both of you coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there discussion to the bill? All right. Mr. Franklin, closing comments. We have a couple of powerful committee members as co-authors. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think this should go a long ways to help us resolve some of our school bus driver shortage that we have in the state. So I appreciate the time and the consideration.
Okay. So, members, the bill is now before us, and I will renew my motion that House File 1649, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Eklund. You're on your way with a couple bills to the House floor. And we have Representative Schultz is here, so... We will now consider House File 145, and I think you were our very first bill, and now you're going to be one of our last policy bills. So I will move House File 145 to be referred to the General Register, and I believe, do you have an amendment there?
I do. I have A1 amendment.
A1, I'll allow members again a little bit of time here to rifle through all your bills. I need the time as well.
Don't have it. Mr. Chair, it was separate. Okay, thank you.
Okay, just give me a sec here. Does everyone have the bill?
Yeah.
It wasn't in our package.
Thank you. All right. Please proceed with the discussion. I do not believe I see an amendment, but
it was handed out.
Handed out separately. Ah, great. Okay, so let's maybe take your A1 first.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we discuss the amendment separately, or can you
get
this bill in
amendment,
shape?
Is this the amendment that you would like to?
I would like to adopt the amendment.
Yeah.
And then
let's
talk
do that
about
first.
The bill?
Yep. So, please explain to us the A1 amendment.
So, the A1 amendment just makes some clarifications and cleans up some language. And this was heard in the Senate earlier this session, and some law enforcement came forward and gave us some additional recommendations on the bill, and this is incorporating those recommendations.
Excellent. Is there discussion to the A1? I will move the A1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. And now we have House File 145 as amended before us in the shape the author would like us to consider it in. Tell us about House File 145.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill that very slightly broadens an existing exception to the prohibition on motor vehicle window tinting. So I have a constituent in my district, and his family member has a medical condition and needs the windows tinted. But if you have this currently in current statute, you have to have that person in the car with you to use that vehicle. And if you are only a one-car family, then it really limits the ability to use that vehicle unless the person with the medical condition is riding in the vehicle. So this just allows that the medical exception that a healthcare provider writes stays with the vehicle rather than the person. So any other family members can use that vehicle without the person being present.
Representative O'Driscoll, thank you for that. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schultz, it sounds like it makes some pretty good sense that you'd have to work with that. My only question is, after the owner is done with the vehicle, does it have to be retrofitted, or does your change continue with a new owner who may not have a person or they themselves be with that aforesaid medical condition?
Mm-hmm. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. That is a very good question. We don't change what is currently in current statute, so that would remain in current statute, and maybe a House research staff could inform us about what currently happens in statute.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, I would anticipate that the vehicle would no longer be able to be operated on roads because the exception is specific to the circumstances of the medical statement. So either shipping it to another state that has a different threshold cutoff on light transmittance might be an option, or I'm not familiar with what kind of retrofit or removal of window glazing is available, but that might be a possibility as well.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schultz, I would ask you to look into that because someone may be selling that vehicle not even thinking about that, mm-hmm. and the purchaser not even knowing about that, and I'd sure hate to see the purchaser put in a situation where they're not in compliance with law when they were involved in a good faith effort to try to purchase and sell that vehicle. So I think that particular area may need a little bit more of your attention before it heads to the desk to get a governor's signature.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the exception currently, we already have this exception in state law, so that would still be a problem with our current law, I believe, of whether or not they can remove the window glazing or notify a buyer if they sell it on the open market. So, but maybe we do need to clean up that language, and so we could look at that in the future or bring an amendment to the floor if this comes as a single bill to the floor.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I deputize you with that duty?
Of course
if that's possible.
Yes, I would love to do that. And I will look to House Research to help me with that.
And thank you for raising that, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz, for bringing us forward. Is the person who gets his prescription limited to utilizing on only one vehicle?
Representative Schultz.
Only on the way the bill is written, it would be tied to the vehicle. So it's tied with the vehicle instead of the person, which is what it currently is. So if the person is traveling in a different vehicle, currently they would have to have their medical waiver with them in that vehicle.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could they get a second prescription for a second vehicle?
Representative Schultz.
If the person needed to switch between two vehicles, then I think that, and they have a medical condition, I would want them to be able to allow to do that. But the situation I'm trying to address is if the person has one vehicle, mm-hmm. and others in the family can no longer drive that vehicle without the person being present.
Representative Torkelson, and I think Mr. Burris also wanted to weigh in a little bit as well, but did you want to?
Okay. Mr. Burris has the floor, yeah. As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, okay, great. Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, just so you're aware, the A1 amendment does allow for up to two vehicles to be specified in the prescription. That is language on 1.11 and 1.12 of the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a good thing Mr. Burris reads more carefully than any of us, I think. So just one more question,
sure,
Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, any idea how common this is? I it's not something I've run across in my experience. I'm guessing it's fairly uncommon. But have you got any statistics as to how often the current law has been utilized by citizens of Minnesota?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do not have a specific statistic, given that I have one constituent in a district of about 40,000, so you can glean some information from that. But given that skin cancer rates are increasing, there might be a higher demand in the future for something like this.
Okay. Great. Yes, Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also was wondering, too, if there was any consideration for PCAs. I know my niece actually has a prescription for this, and so being that she's not the one driving, my brother-in-law, sister, and both my sisters, my sister-in-law, who is her aunt, is also her PCA, and so was wondering if there was any thought to putting maybe adding PCAs into that as well.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kegel. I think that's a great idea. This was limited to family members, and this was part of the amendment that was brought forth by law enforcement because they were worried it would be too broad. Mm-hmm. So we can maybe amend that if it next stop or on the floor. I think that's a good suggestion.
And then I was Representative
Kegel.
And I was also wondering about selling the car as well, because I know when my brother-in-law sold his car with the tinted windows, they left the tinted windows in place and actually sold it to his sister-in-law, who is the PCA. So hopefully we can get some of that worked out as well.
Yes, we will work on that. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representatives Kegel and Schultz. And just as a reminder, the next stop is the floor, so you'll have an opportunity, to amend it there. Any other discussion? Any last thoughts you want to share with us?
Thank you, committee members, for serving on the Transportation Committee and hearing this bill. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate your feedback. Thank you.
Thank you. So, members, then I will renew my motion that House File 145, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you. We are going to take House File 1777 now. That is Representative Elkins's bill on urban residential speed limits. This is going to be an interesting one. So you have an amendment, but before we do that, let's see here.
Yeah, there's a handout in here as well. The amendment is a delete all, which I'll explain.
Okay. So members, before we do the amendment, I'm going to move that House File 1777 be referred to the General Register. But you have a DE1, correct? Everybody in possession of the DE1?
There we go. So if I can see it there, I can see it. Great. Okay, should I explain the amendment?
Yeah, this is an amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like it considered?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So why don't I'll do the DE1 amendment then, members? Proceed.
Proceed, yes. So, members, the original wording of the bill came to me from the Senate, so it was, of course, vague and had included undefined terms.
He says, of course. I love that.
I'm learning. So, working with Pat Dalton and after discussions with personnel from MnDOT and the counties, realized that there's actually a much easier way to skin this particular cat. In the original language, there was, for example, a reference to residential areas, which is a term that is not defined in the statute, but is very similar to terms that are defined in the statute, which I thought would be very confusing. And upon further reflection and having worked on this issue for about 20 years, I remembered that there is already a provision in the statute related to speed limits that enables a 25 mile per hour speed limit in residential roads roadways, if adopted by the road authority having jurisdiction over the residential roadway, and the speed limit adopted under that paragraph is not effective unless the road authority has erected signs designating the speed limit and indicating the beginning and end of the rural residential district for the roadway in which the speed limit applies. So the problem with that provision over time has lied in the definition of a residential roadway, which you'll see at the bottom of the handout. Current law, it is defined as a residential roadway means a city street or town road that is less than 1/2 mile in total length. And as a practical matter, that is effectively limited to cul-de-sacs. So instead of messing elsewhere, the proposed change would just change the definition of a residential roadway, leave everything else the same, and to the definition of a residential roadway, we would add, or in an area zoned exclusively for housing, which is not a collector or arterial street, to make it clear that it would be truly local streets and not the collector or arterial streets that that might also pass through a neighborhood. So with this, it makes it a very minimal change to existing state law, but it makes makes this a provision that cities could actually use. And illustrate this, a couple of pictures. So the one that you have before you now is a typical suburban 36-foot street of the style that was generally built in suburban communities for the last half of the 20th century.
Representative, do you have any kind of feature that would enlarge?
I may need Mr. Howe for that. So. Oh, I see what. I thought he fixed it for me. Is that better?
Frank, maybe we need the keepers to download.
Yeah.
Okay, there we go.
All right.
Yeah. That street would have looked a lot narrower than it actually is.
Okay, I mean, you illustrated a point. But
yeah. No, so this is a typical 36-foot wide residential street of the sort that was typically built in second and third ring suburban communities from about the 60s to the early 2000s. And on this type of a street, which was predominant prominently built during that time, a 30-mile-per-hour speed limit, which is the current default, is perfectly appropriate. Okay. But the history of how these streets came to be 36 feet wide is interesting because it took me over 10 years to find the answer to that because no traffic engineer could tell me. I finally found the answer in a book on the history of American street design. Yes, I am that nerdy. And it came to us not from any highway authority. It was a standard that was promulgated by the Federal Housing Administration back in the 40s, at a time when the suburbs were first starting to grow. And the FHA decided that they were not going to back loans in suburban communities unless those communities had paved streets. And in the absence of any existing standards for how suburban streets ought to be built, they took the only standards they have, which were the standards for state trunk highways of the day, which specified that travel lanes should be 10-foot wide and parking lanes should be 8-foot wide. So two 10-foot travel lanes and two 8-foot parking lanes equals 36 feet. And that is the only reason why these streets, the typical suburban street, was built out to 36 feet wide. But there are many, many, okay, now I'm... There's not an easy way here to actually just forward the pictures. I need to switch pictures here. Let's do. That's a good example. This is a 26-foot wide street in St. Paul. Clearly, 30 miles per hour would not be an appropriate speed limit on this one. I've got a couple of even better ones here. This is a very interesting street. This is Lombard Street in St. Paul, east of Lexington Avenue. It's 22 feet wide, and clearly a 30 mile per hour speed limit would not be appropriate on this street. This is a street called, let's see, which one is this one? Timberglade Road in Bloomington. It's about 20 feet wide, and clearly a 30-mile-per-hour speed limit would not be appropriate on a street like this. So the point is, that cities should have some discretion to designate and post streets where a 25-mile-per-hour speed limit is more appropriate than a 30-mile-per-hour speed limit, which is otherwise the default. The fact that these streets would have to be posted as being 25 miles per hour would pose a constraint on cities doing this willy-nilly, not doing it just where it's necessary. But I think this is an authority that is long overdue for cities to have. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Okay, and thank you, Representative Elkins. Do you have testifiers? I wasn't clear. There were some.
I don't have any that I've organized myself. There may be people in the audience who wish to testify.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify either in favor or opposed to this bill? Then we can have some committee discussion. Okay. Let's discuss the DE1 then, and then we can consider the entire bill.
So yeah. So what again, is the DE1 just simplifies the language. I think it's just a lot more straightforward than the original language in the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, yeah. A1.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Oh, I did.
I'm on the wrong amendment. Sorry. A1, excuse me.
No, DE1.
DE1?
It's a DE1, yeah.
DE1, sorry. Yeah, there's a couple of Elkins bills. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I was right the first time.
This is 1777.
I always assume I'm not, yeah.
I'm the speed limit guy.
I always feel like Representative Rumnick's bringing something up. It's, no.
So,
okay.
1777.
Okay, so, members, just to clarify, the 1777 DE1 is what's before us. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before this gets passed, I just want to make sure that this bill allows for, when you say zone exclusively for housing, could it also have, I have areas in my district that might have a school? On that road, it wouldn't exclude if there's a school there, because that's obviously where we want it to be lower.
Yeah,
I just wanted to make sure that
most cities, schools are within residential zoning districts.
So that would count. It wouldn't exclude if there was.
Well, and schools have, but you can go down to 20 miles per hour when children are present as well. So there's an existing exception for schools.
Right, but it's under different parameters for school safe zones, I believe. But anyway, I just want to make sure that it includes residential areas with schools. Mm-hmm. Could I ask our staff that, if it does?
Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to have to dig into it a little bit.
Okay.
I don't have a response for you right away.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, if we can't get it right away, I would just like to make sure that the bill, when it moves on, that we just make sure that that's covered.
It's necessary, then this would be a simple floor amendment.
Yeah, right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, Mr. Chair, can I say one more thing?
Of course.
I just really want to thank Representative Elkins for doing this, because if we can get speed limits to people to go lower, it would really increase the safety for people who use that roadway, whether they walk on it, bike on it, live on it, and I really appreciate that. And you know, the real strategy is to get people to go those speeds.
Yeah,
so thank you.
The irony of the 36-foot street is that the rationale also turned into, as long as we're making them this wide, we don't need sidewalks because the roads and the people and the cars can share the road. And then we discovered that people drove too fast on those 36-foot-wide streets, and so nobody wanted to walk on them.
Okay. Is there further discussion of House File 1777 as amended, Representative O'Driscoll?
Mr. Chair, I know we've got 1778 coming up, and that talks about cities of the first class, mm-hmm. and 1777, we talked about cities and towns. The question I have is, would these be statutory cities that you're talking about in this section, Representative Elkins?
Representative Elkins.
It doesn't specify either statutory or charter.
Okay, that was my second question, Mr. Chair, on that. An additional question, Mr. Chair?
Proceed.
Thank you. I know that, 1778 And I can also see in 1777 the same issue. Mm-hmm. In the city of St. Paul or in Minneapolis and some of the established neighborhoods back in the days that we were creating those neighborhoods, there were smaller businesses that were in those neighborhoods, so they wouldn't necessarily be exclusively residential. As we started to go to a more suburban, some of that theme may have moved from the core cities into the suburban areas. How are you addressing those kinds of situations where there might have been a converted corner grocery store that's now still a corner grocery store or providing some other kind of service or product that's in that neighborhood, because that wouldn't necessarily meet exclusively, because mm-hmm. the city may have granted an exception on that, and I don't want to have cities get into parsing zoning exceptions and those kinds of things when they're trying to figure out whether or not this would apply.
Sure. This is a very good question.
Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the cities, those corner stores are invariably on streets that we'd be designated as collectors or arterials, and so you would not have the 25 mile per hour speeds on arterial streets.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Driscoll.
What about the cross streets that might be shorter that come across those arterials?
Representative Elkins.
Well, you'd post the speed limit for just beyond where the residential neighborhood starts and the commercial area ends. You would have to post.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Driscoll.
Again, what I'm thinking about is in these neighborhoods where there's maybe just simply and how I've seen them, is oftentimes wood frame construction, lap siding, where there was a living residence upstairs and then there's a business entity downstairs where the proprietor lived on premises. Mm-hmm. That may still be zoned or granted under a zoning exception to a conditional use permit. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering.
It would probably be a conditional use within a residential zone, Mr. Chair, sorry.
Mm-hmm. But to that point, Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, I just want to make sure that a city doesn't have to come back and say, we see further clarification on this. I've got extensive local government experience, mm-hmm. so I'm just trying to save all of us extra time in the future by asking those questions today.
Now, Mr. Chair, I am also lots of local government experience, so I appreciate every single question you're asking.
You and I are nerdy that way, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, great. I believe if there's no other questions, there's another testifier that would like. Mm-hmm. Representative Petersburg and Representative Perkelson.
I'll let the chair go first.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins. You've given us a nice history of street widths. I'd like a little more information about jurisdiction on speed limits. perhaps the department would like to come down or somebody else that knows a little. Or perhaps you would like to enlighten us a little bit more on
No, this on, is, why, this is addressed in the law already, Mr. Chair. So this bill addresses sections in the law where it clearly specifies the roads under the jurisdiction of the local government setting the speed limit. So I know that the counties who I talked to yesterday were very concerned about cities setting speed limits on county roads, and they didn't want that to happen. And so this bill only allows cities to set speed limits in residential areas under their jurisdiction.
Representative Torkel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what's prevented them from doing that up before this bill might be passed?
The definition, the existing definition, this was addressed on the handout. If you look at compare the definitions, the current one with the proposed one, the current definition of a residential roadway is so limiting that it is a practical matter. You can practically only use it on cul-de-sacs.
And, Representative Mr. Chair, so other streets would be considered similar to an arterial in it without
this? They're not considered residential roadways. They would be considered by default urban roadways where the default weight speed limit is 30.
Okay. Yes, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a food for thought, because mm-hmm. Representative Elkins' demonstration of his photos indicate that a speed limit is determined by width of the road. And that if you got 25 or 30, you certainly wouldn't want 30 mile an hour speed limits. But I would argue that we have 40% of our roads are township roads, and a lot of those are gravel. Most of those are gravel, mm-hmm. if not all of them. And a lot of those are certainly less than that. Some of them are only 20 feet wide or so, and that's a 55 mile an hour speed limit. So it's not just the width. I mean, you have to take other factors into it as well. So you're implying was, well, it's this wide, so therefore you would want this distance. That's not the case. It's just food for thought.
No, thank you. Okay. Mr. Chair, no, it's the concept of quote-unquote design speed takes into account road width and curvature and the elevation as well. So there are many factors that come into play, including, is parking allowed, So there's a number of factors, and in the pictures I'm trying to show both road width and curvature and on-street parking and a number of things that would render a 30-mile-per-hour speed limit unsuitable.
Thank you. Mr. Culver, available? I think you were interested in testifying.
Thank you, Chair Horstein.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Mark Culver. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Roseville, also the past president for the City Engineers Association of Minnesota, and I'm representing the City Engineers Association this afternoon, which is a statewide association of municipal engineers and consultants that design, operate, and maintain city roads, utilities, facilities, and other municipal infrastructure. I'm actually going to be making some slight comments on both of Representative Elkins' bills, just to save time for the committee, because I know you have a very...
Probably not going to get to the second one until after session.
Yep.
We hope to finish this one before session.
Yep. So just most of these comments are in relation to 1777, but it also pertains slightly to 1778. To state, first of all, that both of these bills do have some very quality merit in the fact that they're trying to react to a growing desire to change our driving culture in urban and residential areas and simply just slow down our driving and drive, as Representative Elkin can say, you know, drive for the conditions that are reasonable for the street. It's interesting that in 2008, the legislature actually did commission a task force to study the specifics of the speed limit statute, including whether the 30-mile-per-hour statutory speed limit should be modified to 25-mile-per-hour, whether the statutory speed limit of 55 miles per hour is appropriate in rural residential districts, and whether the then current definitions of urban district, rural residential district, and residential roadway are appropriate. And based on that study, there were some modifications made to the definitions, and the study concluded that a change to 25 mile per hour as a statutory speed limit was not warranted, mostly based on lack of support from public safety community, and the fact that a change to the speed limit, even with signs, would likely have little to no effect on the actual speed of the subject roadways. I understand that Representative Elkins' bill is much more specific to certain types of road and such. However, there is a... And since that study, there is certainly a growing culture change. More and more communities do support a change to a 25-mile-per-hour statutory speed limit that would actually be more broad than what this specific bill gets into. And the move towards complete streets and living streets is pushing a recognition that we should consider more than just the car and our design and operation of our roadways. But as we discuss these two specific bills, the engineering community at both the city and county levels are asking for an opportunity to stop and think about the issue of consistency and uniformity in the speed limit bill and how this is applied across all cities in the state of Minnesota. Speed limits that are effective work because they're consistent. A roadway in Grand Rapids that has a 40-mile-per-hour speed limit likely looks and acts very similar to a roadway in Eagan that has a 40-mile-per-hour speed limit. The signs help reinforce that speed limit, but the driver, through experience, has learned what speed limits likely are for certain roadway types. So as we focus that down into residential roadways and urban district roadways, we would like to preserve that consistency. The borders between St. Paul and Roseville, between Minneapolis and Edina, are not always crystal clear. And even with the posting of the signs, there's an expectation from the driver that there's more consistency in local roadways between those communities. So, as I said, the City Engineering Association is advocating for one more chance at assembling a group of practitioners and stakeholders, taking the intent of these bills and recommending language that helps clean up the current statutes on speed limits as well as reinforces or establishes a statutory speed limit on residential and or urban district roadways that can be communicated and enforced evenly and uniformly across the state. This could be done between now and the start of next year's session with a recommendation delivered to the legislature. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much, Mr. Culver. Are there questions for Mr. Culver? Appreciate it. Thank you. I also understand, is Ms. Murray here and interested in testifying? Welcome to the committee, Ms. Murray. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Emily Murray with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota County Engineers Association. My comments are also sort of on both bills, but I'll keep them focused 1777 as well. I want to start by sharing that both AMC and the county engineers have had a long-standing platform position supporting the exclusive role of the Commissioner of Transportation in establishing speed zones on all roadways. This speed study process is one that has served county and city engineers very well for many years, and it has ensured statewide consistency of the evaluation process. County engineers value uniformity and consistency of roadway design and operation, such that drivers do not encounter different expectations of driving behavior as they travel throughout the state. Therefore, it is important that speed limits are implemented in a consistent manner across the state and with proper study in order to protect the safety and the expectations of the traveling public. I'd like to echo what Mr. Culver outlined in his testimony in support of putting together a group of stakeholders to study the language in this bill and in 1778, and to just generally study the speed limit statute. As he mentioned, much has changed since the last stakeholder group was put together back in 2008, and county engineers would be happy to participate and bring recommendations back to the legislature. I would like to thank Representative Elkins for significantly narrowing the scope of both bills through the amendments offered today. There was some ambiguity in House File 1777 prior to the amendment that might have allowed for a city to change the speed limit on a county road as it runs through a residential area, but this has been cleared up. So we appreciate his work on these amendments, but we do just want to register our general support for the current method of changing speed limits across the state. Thank you for your time.
Representative Hausman, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I guess to both of the testifiers, my understanding from Representative Elkins was that, well, not necessarily a question, but just observation. Representative Elkins already told us about past history where, in fact, stakeholders sat down and did just this very thing and came from recommendations. But that still has not solved the very specific problem that he's solving with this bill, which is really narrow, a very unique situation. And so I thought his amendment, which I think clarifies that even more, is helpful. So his bill seems to run counter to the arguments you're making. We have studied, stakeholders have come with recommendations, but this particular niche wasn't dealt with in those recommendations because we enacted some of those recommendations.
Representative Hausman, yes, thank you. And I would agree with that and to Ms. Murray's point as far as refinement of the bill just very recently to help, you know, really focus in specifically. I guess my concern and my colleague's concern is still an opportunity for that continuity, that uniformity to be lost, and some confusion for the driving public as to, you know, is this a 25 or is this a 30? I think what we would really like to get to is, do we really, really want to support a 25-mile-per-hour speed limit on our residential roadways? And even to that point, there are complications to just saying, you know, roadways with only housing on it, particularly as we redevelop areas in Roseville. We're redeveloping areas and we're really promoting mixed use, you know, so that we do have a mix of commercial and residential, even in perhaps maybe not on a traditional collector street and things like that. And I think you're going to see more and more of that even within St. Paul, Minneapolis. So there will always be some things that are kind of slipping through the cracks. And I think if we can, again, with this new culture and with this new drive, no pun intended, towards slower speeds and maybe a more support holistically about the 25-mile-per-hour speed limit, I think maybe we can come together with some broader language that provides more uniformity in the law versus passing this and then saying, oh, well, we missed this, this, and this, and then coming back a year or 2 years later to try to address those things.
Representative Hausman, do you have a follow-up for
yes,
Mr. Culver?
Yes, and I just would observe, just remembering Representative Bernardi's earlier comments, because we're so keenly aware of pedestrian safety, and I think that I recall those pedestrian deaths are going up. I seem to recall some statistic to that, that moving quickly on this one very specific problem to residential areas where kids are running around, there's an urgency, it seems to me, about it. Anytime you have a study and stakeholders, we're talking about sometime off in the future. And so I think that would just be the observation I would make about this bill.
Yeah. Mr. Culver. And if I may, I agree. I think we would be looking at a very short time frame in order to respond, still within, you know, with these same legislators, it's still the same momentum next year, next session. But again, try to be more holistic about it. I think anything that we do, even with signs, even with this bill, is going to require to be effective, is going to require a very concentrated effort on both enforcement and education. And I believe if it's much more holistic and we can get buy-in from the engineering community as well as the municipalities as a whole, then I think we can drive that education and enforcement much better and have much more effectiveness on the desire to reduce those fees in the residential areas.
Representative Houseman? Okay. Representative Elkins, and then is there anyone else that wants? Oh, Representative Runbeck.
I have a question for the testifiers.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Would both of you agree with me that a 30-mile-per-hour speed limit is not appropriate on this street?
Members, I haven't quite seen this interaction before, but I suppose it's...
If I may.
Yes.
I would agree that on this segment of this roadway, 30 miles per hour is not appropriate. However, just past those curves, what does the roadway look like?
It looks like this is a big,
right,
long loop.
But that is, you know, yes, I would agree that for this, a 30-mile-per-hour speed through here is not appropriate.
Okay, Representative Runbeck and Representative Tapke, and I do want to make sure before we recess, is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Okay, why don't we have the testifier, and then we'll have Representative Runbeck and Tapke, and then recess at this point. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Chair and representatives, my name is Peter Buchan. I'm the Assistant State Traffic Engineer for the Minnesota Department of Transportation.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Buchan.
Thank you. Through delegated authority from the Commissioner of Transportation, I'm responsible for reviewing and authorizing speed limits in the state of Minnesota when requested by local road authorities. Currently, 169.14 establishes 8 statutory speed limits. When those statutory limits are utilized, MnDOT does not get involved. We only look at road speed limits on roadways when requested by the local road authority to do so. The current statute with the 30-mile-per-hour urban district does, as Mr. Culver explained, it sets an expectation for drivers, and it's well understood across the state. So there is no signing on most residential streets because the expectation is when I'm in that neighborhood, my speed limit should be 30 miles per hour. That consistency sets expectations for the drivers and for law enforcement. And as they go from location to location or city to city, that expectation is met. As I read this, and I'm sorry, there is 2 bills that are very similar but different, but slightly different in that 1778 allows the establishment of speed limits either above or below the statutory limits, which today the system that's in place where the Transportation Department reviews speed limits does seem to be working and accomplishes what's being done here. So we think that the current system is working. I concur with Mr. Culver's recommendation that a study group would be helpful so that we can get the representatives from the cities and get their perspective as we look at this. I also agree that the modes and the attitudes and the realizations both with respect to pedestrian safety and other modes of travel have changed and that would be a good review of the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Buchan. Any questions for Mr. Buchan? Okay.
Chair, actually, I do.
Okay. Representative Elkins, proceed.
Residential roadways is one of the existing Class 8 classifications, is it not?
Mr. Buchan.
Chair and Representative, yes, it is.
Okay. And how does the existing case violate your principles?
Chair and Representative, the existing case, I agree that this is an improvement to the language, and I appreciate that clarification because, as you stated, it was a very limited application, and the broadening that I think is a good change.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, why don't we do this? We have is there anyone else before in the audience that would like to testify for or against? I have 3 people on the list, and then we'll recess after their comments or questions. Representative Runbeck, Representative Tabke, and Representative Bernardi. So, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For what it's worth, I remember trying to change the speed limit law myself once. Ran into the same buzzsaw, but I think I heard from the testifiers that they were going to go ahead voluntarily and put together a work study group on their own. I don't know if they need language to do that, but it sounds like they're ready to go, and it just seems like that maybe a few more months of looking at it and getting a comprehensive approach would be very beneficial. That's my comment.
All right, thank you. Representative Tabke.
Ready?
Vice Chair.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Elkins, thank you very much for bringing this forward. I just want to make 2 points with regard to this. I think that while I was mayor, this is one of the major things that was constantly coming up was speed limits, and the city could do nothing about them. It drove us absolutely crazy because there are places where it had to be, it absolutely should be reduced, but cities didn't have the ability to do that. So I firmly believe that you are on the right track, and cities will make the right choices and do what is necessary to make sure that their streets are safe for their communities and make that local control piece, make the right decisions for themselves. Secondly, what this will also hopefully do is push cities and counties and townships more into understanding the direct relationship between engineering and design and speed, and the fact that the reason why we have speeding is because the roads weren't engineered correctly for the speed that they want in the neighborhood. And so I think as we learn more and really understand how that continues to move forward, that cities are retrofitting streets and really heading in the right direction. So a 30-mile-an-hour street feels like a 30-mile-an-hour street, and a 20-mile-an-hour mm-hmm. street feels like a 20-mile-an-hour street. And we've got a long way to go with the counties in doing that, but cities are understanding it. So thank you very much for pulling this in.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So last comment before we vote is Representative Bernardi.
Okay, I just wanted to, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chair, I like that sound.
Don't get me in trouble.
Yeah, right, exactly. I wanted to find out, I'm hearing about this task force being mentioned. Is that something that can happen without legislation? And is legislation required? And I would imagine the task force would be broader than strictly engineers. That's my question.
Is that a question to the author or to MnDOT?
Probably, Mr. Chair, probably MnDOT.
Okay. Mr. Buchan?
Hello, Chair and Representative. I think it could clearly include more than just engineers. And it should include units of local government as well as law enforcement. The last study that was referred to included engineering representatives from the cities and counties and law enforcement from both state patrol and local units of government. So this could do the same.
Representative Bernardi, one final.
Okay, yeah. So, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to ask, would legislation be required to do this? And I definitely would want to weigh in on the stakeholders so that would be on that committee.
Mr. Buchan.
Chair and Representative, I don't know that legislation would be required. We can convene a committee without legislation. Then my question would be, how do we submit that to the legislature?
Well, this is a very hypothetical situation, but I think, you know, there's often communication to the appropriate committee chairs and ranking members. Sometimes there is a communication with the speaker and the minority leader. So I think that your commissioners would probably be the one to make these inquiries. But there are channels, and this does happen routinely. But it seems like we're discussing a hypothetical at this point. Representative Tabke.
Mr. Chair, is there any reason why this cannot move forward and a task force be implemented as well? I think they can move concurrently and be
this
fine.
This does not appear to be mutually exclusive. Okay. Representative Elkins, you can comment on this. Would you prefer that we lay this over until after the recess or vote on this? I think we are ready to vote, but if people want to continue talking about it, we can.
Closing comments.
Absolutely.
We bring this one home. What a point. I have served on numerous such committees myself, including several years on MnDOT's Complete Streets Task Force. Were you on that with me? We'll talk about that. Yeah. So this is these kinds of things that that particular task force resulted in significant changes to MnDOT's design standards, but not speed limit standards. As the representative from MnDOT points out, agrees with me, I'm not creating any new categories of speed limits here. I'm only changing the definition for what one of the categories means in a way that would give cities the flexibility to, in limited cases, be able to experiment with these kinds of things. The picture I have before you is from Edina, where they have taken to using a different loophole in the law that says you can set 25-mile-per-hour speed limits on parkways. So they reconstruct their streets on a complete streets manner, call them parkways, and set the speed limit at 25. So there's a lot of good data points occurring out there right now that could be used in a study. So I would say we should move forward with this bill and constitute the study and use the changes that result from this bill to in the study.
Thank you very much, Representative Elkins. So two things we need to do here. First is to vote on the DE1 amendment. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. Now, the bill is before us. House File 1777 as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. The motion prevails. Oh. Oh. Okay. We do have a split decision on this, but the motion does prevail. So, members, just a quick announcement here before we recess. We will be coming back to this room 15:15 minutes after session, so we can wrap up relatively quickly. That was referred to the General Register. I'm sorry. The motion was to refer that to the General Register. We have four bills left, 1623, 1545, 1778, 1865, and 2434, five bills. And so make sure you put those in your folder. So with that, members, we are in recess till 15 minutes after session. I would like to reconvene the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Division agenda. We had a quorum earlier, so that counts as a quorum now. So Representative Petersburg minutes. These would be for the 12th, Tuesday the 12th meeting.
March 12th, yep. I so move the minutes.
Thank you. All the minutes are moved. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion carries. I didn't do it. I wasn't offsides that time. I was penalized for being offsides. Okay. Representative Elkins, you have your second street-related bill, 1778, and the motion there is, hold on one second. You have an A1 amendment. However,
yes.
Before we do that, I'll move this to the General Register.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to explain your bill and amendment?
Yes. This bill is this is speed limit day in the committee. So this bill is brought to me by the City of Minneapolis on behalf of the cities of the first class, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and Duluth. And this would give those cities somewhat more leeway. As Representative O'Driscoll pointed out this morning, a lot of these large, older cities have particularly challenging street networks that are unique from most of the other cities in the state. And so they're looking for additional flexibility, slightly different than the flexibility sought in 1777. The bill as originally drafted was very general. The author's amendment puts more specificity around it, some guardrails, specifies that the authority being sought, would be, the city will use this authority under this paragraph, must develop procedures to set speed limits based on safety, engineering, and traffic analysis, and at a minimum, the safety, engineering, and traffic analysis must consider national urban speed limit guidelines and studies, local traffic crashes, and methods to effectively communicate the change to the public. So it puts a little empiricism around the authority.
discussion. I think Representative Cosden has a few things to say about this one.
Yeah, it might be a little early for this, but thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Elkins, how would this affect the speed limit on Interstate 35?
Representative Elkins.
Shouldn't at all, because this would just be city streets again.
And maybe that's an author's amendment that you could work on for later in session to increase the speed limit on the interstate approaching downtown St. Paul.
Which one you're talking about, too.
It seems to come up every year, so.
That's a important amendment that I'm sure we're likely to see this year on the transportation bill. And it's 35E, just for clarification.
Sure.
It's 35E.
The practice fee, right? Thank you.
Yeah. Let's adopt your DE1. Is there a discussion to? I'm sorry, A1. Is there a discussion to the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. Discussion to the bill. Do you have testifier?
I have a testifier from the city of Minneapolis, yes.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Mosing. I'm a traffic operations for the city of Minneapolis and have been in traffic operations with the city of Minneapolis for 25 years. I'm here to speak in support of this bill. Vehicle speeds have been the base element of design since I've been involved in traffic engineering. A long history has been established in context with driver behavior that has established a means by which speed limits can be determined. For the most part, the 85th percentile speed, which is the speed at which 85% of the vehicles are going or going under, is a long-standing approach and used to determine speed limits today. In recent history, vehicle speed and speed limits have been part of a more in-depth analysis pertaining to safety. Studies are providing evidence confirming that there is a direct link between speed limits and safety, and the safety benefits of lower speed limits. These studies conducted by such agencies as the Federal Highway Administration, and the National Cooperative Highway Research Program. In addition to these studies, there have been proven physics related to lower speed limits, which include an increase in peripheral vision, reaction time, and stopping distance. Speed is a top five factor in contributing to crashes in the state of Minnesota, and 31% of all traffic fatalities nationwide, speed is a factor. Nationwide data indicates that as speeds rise, the risk of severe injury also rises. For pedestrians, you're twice as likely to be severely injured by a car going 31 miles an hour as opposed to a car going 23 miles an hour. As a pedestrian in Minneapolis, you're more likely to be severely injured on a roadway with a higher posted speed limit. In first-class cities, the unique nature of the urban grid, along with dense population, contributes to the roadway environment. Typically, Minneapolis has 300 to 600-foot block lengths, limited right-of-way, and competing needs of this right-of-way. This includes private vehicle movement, trucks, buses, light rail, parking, pedestrians, and bicycles. The distribution of this right-of-way can create corridors where speeds as posted are simply not logical. To add, parks, hospitals, schools, bus stops, rail stops, and senior living centers all border this right-of-way. Some of the doorways to these facilities are as little as 10 feet from a moving traffic lane. Also, these facilities draw the vulnerable transportation users, such as children, seniors, and physically challenged. In summary, the rationale of using 85% percentile speeds as a means to establish speed limit does not have a universal fit. There is not strong evidence that 85th percentile speed equates to a speed with the lowest crash rate on all roadway types. An example of early success of lowering speed limits in Boston, Massachusetts, most speeds in Boston were lowered from 30 miles an hour to 25 miles an hour. The early results of this implementation show that the average speed decreased by 0.3 miles per hour. The vehicles traveling over 25 miles per hour decreased by 2.9%. Now, these are small changes. However, vehicles traveling over 30 miles an hour was reduced by 8.5%, and most notably, the vehicles traveling over 35 miles an hour were reduced by 29.3%. This is a very important finding given the fact that crash severity also rises so dramatically as speeds rise. Wisconsin already allows cities to lower their speed limits on their streets. This bill would not create inconsistencies. Speed transition zones are numerous in our transportation system. The ability granted through this bill would provide means by which speed limits could be established that potentially lower vehicle speeds and in turn reduce crashes and fatalities. This would all be data-driven. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions for Mr. Mossing? Representative O'Driscoll and Representative Torkelson, you want to go? Okay, we've got Torkelson, O'Driscoll, and Petersburg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the testimony. I just want to ask my history question again. Surely this issue hasn't just come up suddenly this year. I mean, we have a long history of traffic limitations in all cities. What is the urgency of doing this now? I'm not sure if that's for the author or the testifier, whoever wants to take it.
Mr. Chair, we may both want to address that.
Okay. Go ahead. You can start.
As the testifier indicated, there's been, in the last 10 to 15 years, has been a great deal of additional research done onto this. A lot of the things that were just accepted knowledge in the traffic engineering profession, the lore, were accepted as truth without actually having any empirical evidence behind them. Now, through organizations like the Transportation Research Board and its National Cooperative Highway Research Program, people are actually researching the relationship between street width and speed and fatalities, speed limits, width and what the research is telling us is that everything that the traffic engineering profession has believed, taken on faith for half a century, a lot of it is just not correct. And so I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I think what he's telling you is that there's a lot of good new evidence that that safety can be improved by things that have simply been forbidden by current law, just because the accepted wisdom has been accepted without any supporting empirical evidence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would say that, with my 25 years of experience in Minneapolis dealing with traffic operations, the long-standing reasoning and logic behind setting speed limits has not necessarily been data-driven, and as Representative mentioned, these new findings with regard to speed limits and speed in general has evolved my thinking from what I grew up with in the engineering world to a new perspective on how we deal with speeds and how we can effectively, through speed management, through speed limit management, reduce severe injury and fatalities on the roadway system.
Representative Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. Do we run the risk of making the speed limit landscape too complicated by having too many speed limits, changes in speed limit, and drivers just kind of getting confused or unaware of what particular limit they're under at a certain street?
Mr. Mosing or Representative Elkins?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think with the amendment as it's written, we'll dig into issues like that. There's not been a conclusion on that. However, I would say that we got a lot of good people, a lot of good engineers, and that they can put their minds to it to come up with a solution to that issue that would be simple and easy to understand.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. So why, to the author, I think, in this case, why just the first-class cities are we giving this kind of leeway to.
You know, the bill
Representative
came
Elkins.
Senator, Mr. Chair, from the city of Minneapolis, what I would say is that the cities of the first class do tend to have more research to conduct this kind of, more resources to conduct the kind of research that would be necessary to implement this would be the primary reason. But if what these guys do pans out, then absolutely it should be expanded.
Well, thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you just allow me the liberty for a moment, I had an experience this morning as I was approaching the SOB parking ramp. You know, there's the lit crosswalk where there's the flashing lights that warn people when someone's crossing the street. I was in the right-hand lane slowing down because there were people in the crosswalk, and some, I won't say what I'm thinking, person in a car came speeding around me, veered in front of me, and missed a pedestrian in the crosswalk by what looked to me like mere inches. It maybe was more than that, but it got my heart rate going. And
it's called a multiple threat accident.
The way people drive is just alarming. So if Mr. Traffic Engineer, if you can get people to slow down, more power to you.
Representative, was it O'Driscoll, and then Petersburg, and then Mason.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just one comment, and then I'm gonna pass because Representative Torkelson did get most of the questions I was looking at. Mm-hmm. For the record, I was nowhere near Representative Torkelson this morning at the time that he's referenced.
You were not the
I was nowhere near him in that vicinity.
Okay. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think for this maybe for both, but certainly for the testifier. You know, you talked about a couple of things. One is that one of the concerns I have about this bill is the fact that the information that you said about Boston, in which you said most of the streets went down to 25, makes it a whole lot easier for the people and the public that are driving to understand it's 25. But if you have some 25 and some 30, some 35, some 40, et cetera, then it makes it much more difficult for the people that are driving through that community. And unfortunately, it's not just the people that live in the community that are driving through those areas. We have people from all over the state. And to help make things more intuitive about what the speed limits are when you don't know where there's a speed limit sign, and not every street has a speed limit sign, then you need to have some sort of intuition about what it is based upon the history throughout the rest of the state. So I have some concerns about us trying to make this that difficult for doing this. But my question comes to you. You mentioned that you had some streets in which there's proximity to roads, doorways of only 10 feet and children and so forth. I think there is a process for you to have that reevaluated by the State Highway Department, DOT. Have you pursued that? Have they been difficult to work with? Have they not agreed with your perception about speed limits?
Proceed, Mr. Mosing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the city of Minneapolis, we have over 100 public schools, and the disparity from speed limit zones, and I think that's what you're referring to, would be an approach that would be make it, I would think, close or more difficult to comprehend. And so what with this bill, with a unified system, easier to understand that it is what it will be. And, you know, 25 has been talked about a lot here, but through studies and evaluating metrics, you know, a determination will be made. But to make it uniform on every city street, I think would be more understandable and more consistent.
Like follow up.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that's the point that I'm getting to. We already have an agency that has that experience that can make it universal, et cetera. That's the Department of Transportation. And so since there is an avenue for you to go to the Department of Transportation and have this reviewed and validated, that also would then help with the overall statewide consistency of the plan. And so giving this to each individual city then to try to do their own project with their own engineering staff and so forth when we already have that in the Department of Transportation seems to be, to me, redundant, not cost-effective, and something that we really ought to consider strongly. So I would also ask you to consider using the department and the options that are available as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I think Representative Elkins wants to respond to that
as well. So if you take a request to MnDOT right now, Mr. Chair, you would the only criteria they'll use to evaluate is they'll do a speed study on the street, and they'll tell you that the speed limit ought to be set at the speed at which at least 85% of the cars are moving, which is precisely what Mr. Mosley said the city is trying to get away from, because frequently a city will request that kind of a study, and the study will reveal that, yeah, people are going way too fast on this street, but since they are going way too fast on this street, surely that must mean it's reasonable. It's circular logic, and that's exactly what the cities are trying to get away from, be able to base it more on safety, just on how are people driving on that street right now.
Representative Petersburg.
In that case, then I would say maybe it's time for us to also review then the Department of Transportation's values on doing that, rather than do all of this work that is just redundant, et cetera, because I do think it's important for us to have consistent policies throughout the state for traffic, and just because of the ability for everybody to know what the laws are from one city to the next. And so, and just Mr. Chair,
Representative Elkins, and then Representative Elkins can respond, and then I would like to move on to Representative Mason, Representative Koznick.
Yeah, within, Mr. Chair, in any city, you're going to see a range of speeds on different streets from 30 to 35 to 40 to 45, 50, and you'll know by the characteristics of the street will give you a good clue, but you're going to look at the speed limit signs as a confirmation as well. And we're in a situation right now with, 30 being the absolute minimum just about anywhere, that even when 30 is not a reasonable speed on the street, it's there at 30 just for the sake of consistency and no other reason, even when it's clearly not appropriate in that particular context.
Thank you. By the way, do you have additional testifiers, Representative? Representative Mason, and then Representative Koznick, and then I'm going to ask if there's anyone else that wants to testify, and we can move towards a vote. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This discussion takes me back to my city council days, which we spent a lot of time trying to stop or slow down cars. Mm-hmm. And most of the time I was unsuccessful or really difficult. And the fact that you have statistics that showed it worked in one city, I find really amazing. What I do remember, for instance, is we had one street, it was a collector street, where one of our police officers lived. We would constantly have police cars on there. They gave out a lot of tickets, but it still didn't really make any difference. We now have a lighted sign, you're going so many miles an hour, as a way to try to deal with that. The other thing is everybody wants a stop sign on their street.
That's work.
And yes, and now on my street now I have two stop signs, and the deal was it's really hard to deny people a stop sign because they think it's so important. But the problem is when people stop for the stop signs, then they try to make it up as soon as they get past the stop sign. And by the time they get to my house, they are going well past 30 miles an hour, even though it's like half a block down. The second one's half a block down. So, I mean, this is...
Well, Mr. Hill, it's also...
Just a comment, this is... The statistics that you have are really interesting considering what my past experience has been.
Thank you, Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, that when you put a stop sign in a place where it's unexpected, usually the accident rates go up.
Point well taken. Mm-hmm. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein, and to the Mr. Mosley, the traffic engineer, I think is that your title? I'm kind of curious if you can confirm the high crash contribution factors for crashes and accidents. I think I've heard that speed differential is a big factor for a lot of crashes, and if you'd comment on that, and then how this bill might mitigate speed differentials, and especially when we're changing speed limits in certain roads there. Some passengers may or may not be prepared for a speed change.
Mr. Mosley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, speed differential plays a high role on mainly high-speed roadways. Rural roadways, speed limits 55, 60, 65 miles an hour. In the city of Minneapolis and in other first-class cities, we're talking about much lower speeds, and we're talking about speeds that are in conjunction with the environment around them, which would be limited right-of-way, short blocks, number of signals. So speed differential, although not studied in this particular type of environment, of an urban environment, I don't see that as playing a role at all in the increase of crashes.
Representative Koznick.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the education on that. That's valuable information, and I think there's a bill moving for commonly known as the Slowpoke Bill, and I think that's a bill that I might have to sign on to, and I would love to have some discussion in this committee about.
Thank you, Representative Koznick. Any response from either of you? Okay, great. I have no one else on the list, so I just did want to ask if there was anyone else in the audience that wanted to testify in favor or opposed, and also ask the committee if they have any final comments or questions. Okay, seeing none, then Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 1778 be referred to the General Register.
Excuse me?
Oh, as amended. Sorry, as amended to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. All those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Nice. Not offside. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So we have a couple of bills from Representative Wolgamott. And my understanding, Representative Wolgamott, is that you would like to move your House File 1545 first. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'll let you get settled here.
That's the first time I've ever heard of Leon Lilly.
Okay, Representative Wilma, I think you're all set to do your own motion, so I'm not going to do one for you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that House File 1545 be moved to the General Register.
Okay, House File 1545 is before us. Would you like to present the bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here tonight to present House File 1545. This bill addresses the colors used for the rub rails on school buses. The coloring on the buses is purely cosmetic and does not affect the safety of the bus. This change was actually included in last year's vetoed supplemental budget bill, and I'm bringing it back tonight in hopes that we can get this taken care of this year. I'm joined today by Scott McMahon with the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, who can give more details of the bill, and I also want to note that this bill has the support of the Office of People Transportation Safety and the State Patrol. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to present my testifier.
Hey, thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Scott McMahon of the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, and I will keep my testimony short and sweet. In your packet, you should have a picture of a school bus. Just to give you a sense as to what we're talking about here, the belt line is the yellow section that you see with the word Southwest written on it. Under state statute, that belt line is allowed to be yellow with black lettering, as you see in this picture, or it can be black with yellow lettering, as you would see on some buses. The rub rails are the black lines you see highlighted on the picture. What this bill is asking us to do is to permit the what would be identified by the third and fourth arrow in this picture, for those two rub rails to be yellow if a bus operator chooses to do so. The reason we're asking for this is we have a handful of operators across the state who are not in compliance with state law We're just trying to bring everything in compliance. This doesn't deal anything with the safety of a bus. The rub rail itself is a safety feature. The coloring of the bus or the coloring of the rub rail has nothing to do with the safety. We do follow national standards to have school buses be black and yellow. This is just allowing a couple of the pieces to be yellow or black. And I'm happy to take any questions that people may have.
Questions? Okay. There's discussion to the bill? Representative Wolgamott, did you want to make any final comments?
Thank you,
Representative Torkelson. What time out?
I was momentarily distracted.
That's okay. Representative Torkelson.
So, not to tell you or the author how to run things, but we do have some bus language in 1623.
This exact language.
So,
yeah.
Would you like to explain what you're up to?
No, I just saw a bill from Representative Wolgamott, and I didn't realize it was in our other bill.
Sorry, what was the question?
It was procedural, not substantive.
Okay, so on to any further discussion?
None.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and I urge that you join me and the Office of People, Transportation, Safety and the State Patrol in supporting this legislation.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the motion prevails. Okay, so we have another bill from Representative Wolgamott that is not in House File 1673, to my knowledge. Do you have a motion for this one, Representative Wolgamott?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that House File 1865, as amended, be referred to the General Register.
Okay. Okay. Have an amendment that you would like to move as well?
I would like to move the this amendment. It's a very simple word replacement, deleting electric and inserting zero emission on page 2, line 7.
Does everybody have the amendment? Okay. Is there discussion? All those in favor of the – I'll move the A19-0187. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. We now have the bill as amended and as the author would like us to consider it. And before us, Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here to present House File 1865. This bill amends the state transportation goals to include the promotion of zero-emission vehicles and to consider the impact of vehicle emissions on public health. Poor air quality contributes to respiratory diseases that can lead to premature deaths. New technologies like electric vehicles have no tailpipe emissions, so they will improve air quality and public health. Electric vehicles will also significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions and, if charged overnight, can help lower electricity rates for all customers. These changes simply require MnDOT to consider public health impacts and to promote technologies that will improve the lives of all Minnesotans. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to present my testifier.
Mr. Twite?
Yep.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Andrew Twite with Fresh Energy. We are a St. Paul-based nonprofit organization that provides research and analysis on energy policy issues across the state. We're very supportive of this bill because we think that transportation sector emissions do have a big impact on public health. So according to the State Department of Health and Pollution Control Agency, air quality problems contribute to about 2,000 deaths per year in the Twin Cities. To put that into context, that's about five times more deaths than occur in traffic accidents across the state. So the impacts on public health are significant, and we think it's important that the transportation policy goals reflect that. We also appreciate that this bill not only raises a problem, but also identifies possible solutions in zero-emission vehicles, which do not have tailpipe emissions at all, and so can have really tremendous benefits for public health. And as the representative said, can also provide additional benefits in terms of broad environmental and economic benefits. So we're very supportive of this. We urge you all to support it, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you for testifying. Any questions for Mr. Twight? Okay. Yes, Representative Rumbeck.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Obviously, it's not possible to know how that additional language will show itself in decisions made regarding state fleets, so we don't know the cost that this might impose. So it sounds really nice, but, you know, we don't know how the department will use it and what kind of policies will flow exactly. I mean, it's obviously things are probably going to cost more. Certain types of vehicles we just saw today, right? The buses are 50% more costly, things like that. So, I don't know. It's hard to say no, but it's. I think we also know that, you know, things will become more prescriptive, I suppose, from the department.
So, either Mr. Twight or the author have any response?
Yeah,
you can take the fifth if you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I would note that electric vehicle costs are falling really rapidly, so battery pack is the main difference in upfront prices right now. Battery pack prices have fallen about 80% over the last 8 years. They're forecasted to keep falling into the near future, at which point electric vehicles will be about the same price up front. It's also worth noting that they have really significant fuel costs and maintenance cost savings too. So even when a car is more expensive up front, it can still have a lower total cost of ownership over the life of the vehicle. So,
Mr. Chair,
and then Representative,
sir, I didn't get your name, but do you have that data available that can show over a lifetime two different vehicles, one electric, one whatever?
Yeah, I mean, a specific analysis would depend on the exact vehicles and how much you're driving and things like that. But the data on battery cost reductions and things like that is all public. I'd be happy to share it with the committee.
That would be great. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rundbeck. Did you have you seem to be positioning yourself for a question.
I am, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Torkel.
Thank you for reading my sign. So what's the current rebates on an electric vehicle purchase?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So the rebate depends on the manufacturer. So the federal tax credit is $7,500, up to $7,500, depending on the size of the battery in the vehicle. But it also phases out after the manufacturer sells 200,000 vehicles. So Tesla and GM have just reached that mark and are starting to phase down now. For other manufacturers who have not sold as many electric vehicles, it is still that full $7,500.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the competitive pricing that you referenced earlier, is that include the rebate or is it
the rebate? It includes the rebate, but so the whole idea with the tax credits is they're planned to phase down as the technology advances and battery costs fall. So in an ideal world, as they phase out, the battery costs make up for that to the point where the incentive can completely come out and the cars will still be cost competitive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are we living in the ideal world? Is that happening?
I mean, nobody knows what the future is going to hold, but Bloomberg New Energy Finance, for example, forecasts that in 2024, the upfront cost will be the same, even without incentives. So,
Representative Rundbeck.
Thank you.
No more questions? Okay, Representative Rundbeck.
So it's just a curious question, perhaps, but so these two simple words, I mean, could they be the basis for a proposal, you know, next biennium that we outfit the state in charging stations and, you know, whatever that cost is, or we have to do that?
It's really up to the
right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. It's really up to the Department of Transportation how they choose to interpret this. It doesn't specify anything about charging infrastructure or vehicle procurements. It's
however, Mr. Chair, if you have very aggressive folks out there, I mean, they could sue, of course, the department for not complying and not promoting the way state law says they should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I guess to me, let's have the department. They know what's supposed to be the right thing to do. I don't know that we need this language, frankly. I mean, we're not there, in my view. We should do it when we're ready, but I don't think we're ready.
Thank you, Representative Rumbeck. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm breaking my own rule by talking, but I just wanted to point out these are our transportation goals. If you read all the rest of them. We're not doing anything terribly ambitious about all those either. So my expectations are not particularly large when I read this, but they're just goals.
That's right.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, I'm kind of looking through here, looking for what is the cost of this bill or estimated to cost to the taxpayers or MnDOT?
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that it's just simply putting the goal in place.
Representative Kosnick.
So the low emissions or zero emission vehicles, apparently to the author, don't have a cost. And, you know, I guess I'm thinking that there should be a cost to that. But is the department supportive of this?
Mr. Dean is here, and would it be able to answer your question, Representative Kosnick? Mr. Rudine, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs. And, yes, we have no objection to the language. In fact, we're already doing many of these things today. We have some fully electric vehicles in our fleet. The governor's budget proposal includes a $25 surcharge on electric vehicles to install additional electric charging facilities around the state. So, you know, I don't think we really view this as a big change to what we're doing already. We have a chief sustainability officer that Commissioner Zelli appointed last fall, and that position is continuing. We also have an office of connected and automated vehicles, which is not directly related to the electrification of the fleet, but it seems that that's how these connected automated vehicles are evolving, is that many of them will be fully electric. So I think, you know, it gives us, as was stated, some additional goals, but I don't think it's a revolutionary change that would impose any additional costs on the department.
Okay, thank you for that. Is there any further discussion of House File 1865? Oh, Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with a lot of the goals or statements that are made in this legislation, but I guess I still have some real problems with actually the MnDOT promoting or using their limited resources for advertising for electric cars. And again, in my experiences, people look at electric cars because they would like to have one. They usually decide not to have it because of the cost. So I guess I honestly don't know if this is truly necessary. And then the other thing, it would seem to me, if we're doing it from a health perspective, wouldn't that be better for the Department of HHS to be doing than MnDOT?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So to the cost point, I think the technology is really changing very rapidly, and the costs are falling extremely fast. So, for example, a 2012 Nissan Leaf had a base MSRP of $39,000 and could only go 73 miles on a full charge. And in 2019, the base price for a new Leaf is $29,000, and it has more than double the range. So the battery price prices have really fallen at a truly staggering pace, about 20% year over year, and that is reflecting in the price of the cars and in the ranges of them as well. So, okay.
And I did hear that, and I might mention, I think it was Commissioner Marion Green gave a real good, made some really positive comments about her electric car, and you could probably use her as a doing a commercial just for all the points that she made. So it's, as I said, I just don't think that it's not a factor that people don't know about it. It's just they're not at that point where they are willing to put out the money. So once you get the money going down, I think you will find people willing to buy more of the electric cars.
Thank you. Representative Driscoll, did you have a comment?
Well, yes, question? Mr. Chair, and I'm maybe going to show my lack of understanding of some of the terms here. I was wondering if Mr. Rudin or maybe the bill author would be able to help me with the definition of zero emissions. What does that exactly mean when we talk about zero emissions? And I'll put it in context. So we've got alternative fuels that are out there that can be used. What happens if we have other gases, like we'd have propane? That is an emission, but based on fossil fuel, it might have a lower CO emission than petroleum unleaded gas or other types of things. And I guess I'm just wondering if we ever get to a point where there might be something like a hydro type of or a hydrogen.
Right.
What does that mean? Is that a zero emission or is that a low emission? I guess I'm just trying to decipher what does that exactly mean? Talk about emissions.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. I think that's an excellent and timely question, and I'm thinking that might be one for Mr. Twight.
Yes, thank you, Representative. So zero emissions typically refers to zero tailpipe emissions, so it including electric vehicles, hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, like you mentioned, and other technologies that frankly haven't even been invented. But the statute as exists already mentions low emissions vehicles, which would include propane or liquid natural gas or flex fuel vehicles or things like that. So this is just adding a new class into the definition that already includes the vehicles you mentioned.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's helpful. So then I have a question that we're chaining the fuel source back. So the vehicle itself is low emission, but what about the source that produces the fuel source or fuel cell? Does that also have to be low emission, or how are we looking at that, or would that be construed in goal preparation?
So the example would be if the electricity was from a coal plant or something like that.
Correct.
Mr. Twight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So that's a very good question. I think the value of the addition of zero emissions vehicle in the context of this bill is the impacts that it does have on public health, because removing that tailpipe emissions from right where people are driving, which is where people live and work and play, has really significant public health benefits, even if there is a comparable amount of emissions, you know, coming out of the smokestack far away from residential areas, right? But more importantly, the generation mix, electricity generation mix in Minnesota has been diversifying really rapidly. Coal is playing a smaller and smaller part. Natural gas and renewables are paying larger. And for the average Minnesotan today, the emissions of electric vehicle will be about half as much as the average gas car. And that will just continue to increase as the electricity generation mix changes over time.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I do want to underscore that I understand what you're talking about, the local emission by the vehicle itself as it's traversing around the community and stuff, but someone's public health then would be affected by the generation of that electricity, as you said, Mr. Chair, from a coal-powered source or what have you, and those emissions go into the air. And we have some power plants in the state of Minnesota that use coal base load that would look to try to change those or that. I just want to make sure that we don't have an issue, that the two are distinctly separate, that it's the vehicle versus the source, because if it all gets wrapped into one, it makes it a very difficult goal for anyone to try to achieve. I don't know if that necessarily needs an answer. It's just more of a statement, Mr. Chair.
correct.
Or response.
No, it's an important point. Representative Wolgamott?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to remind that this bill is just simply adding in, you know, we've got promoting increasing use of high occupancy vehicles, low emission vehicles. You know, we're just bringing these goals up to the new technologies that are available here in 2019 so that we as a state and as a Department of Transportation can be taking a look at the options available and, you know, making sure that that's working for Minnesotans.
Correct. Well, thank you. Good discussion, members, on both sides. Is there any further discussion? Okay, then, Representative Wolgamott, I will renew your motion that House File 1865, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed? The motion prevails. So thank you very much, Representative Wolgamott. And
members,
you've got
chair.
A couple bills on the way here. The next bill is actually the author is Representative Lilly, but he's not here. But we do have Representative Moeller. And I think Representative Tabke is going to be part of this effort as well, or no? Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. Great. Well, welcome back to the committee, Representative Moeller. And members, just so you know, this is the DPS policy bill. And, of course, parts of this were heard in public safety. There is a...
What number are we talking about?
What's that?
What number? What file number?
2434. Just, if we could just hold 1 minute, members.
Lily's not here, so
can we hear it on the internet? Okay, all right. Members, sorry about this. We just got a news bulletin that this may not be in our committee's possession as of yet.
I heard, so, Mr. Chair, I just heard the same thing, too, and I wonder if we can just do it for informational purposes then at this point?
Well, it's not really in our possession, but I'll consult with House Research and the ranking member, and we'll make a decision.
Ranking member? So we're here for financial purposes, and then what?
Then I imagine that we'll have heard it, and at perhaps an appropriate time. I don't know when that would be.
And where is the bill located at the moment?
Okay, hold on. Are you, Mr. Burris, know where what this is? Where we are? Okay, this seems.
It has to meet in the Senate. It's got to be tomorrow.
We don't even have a list, do we?
Okay. What are the rules about that?
That's 32 versus
32?
I don't either. This is 34.
Right.
The agenda is 34, not 32.
That is.
Joe's thinks it's 32.
What does the list say?
Well,
predatory vendor registration.
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, has this moved in the Senate? I think we have just a base. If this is a policy bill and it has not
correct.
Yet moved in the Senate, and we don't have it in our possession tonight, and
there's
it needs
very
to pass
little we can do.
There's not a thing we can do to get this to meet deadline.
Exactly. That's exactly what we were discussing. And we'll answer that question shortly. Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think if we, not hearing it tonight, but if we hear it next week, we would send it to Rules, and then Rules can decide what they're going to do with it, whether it gets sent down or not. There is that path that we can go down. It's
that
not the most favorite path to go down, but that is a possibility also.
Yeah. That is, we reserve that for very special cases, but that is an option as well. So we're just going to check on the Senate status, and then we can. But it's likely, those of you who have been waiting for this bill, I'm leaning heavily to not hearing it at this point, but we'll make a final determination. We could just be in recess for a couple of minutes, and we'll. Members, we'll take a five-minute recess.
No. Just don't hear it. Hear it next week and take. Members, I'll reconvene the committee. You know, unfortunately, there's really not a path for this right now, and I apologize. We just learned this in the last few minutes, we are on a little bit of a deadline because a number of our members are going to need to leave at 7 for another committee. So, you know, if you think that, I think at this point it's not even in our committee or committee's position. I can't even lay it over, so I apologize.
Thank you. That's okay. Thank you so much for looking into it. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
All right. Deadline week, things happen.
Maybe.
There's Lee.
Oh,
and where are we meeting?
All right. We are now taking up the final bill, 1623. Are we going to take the Representative Hausman rule of no one gets to talk for the? No, we won't do that.
Mr.
Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, you know, there's been a lot of breaking of people's own rules around here today. Representative Hausman's been speaking when she's, you know, kind of has her own personal bow next to speak, not to speak. And the chair has actually been very funny today, breaking his own rule about who's supposed to be the funniest member of the committee.
Perfect. I apologize.
All right, so
we're just an unruly bunch.
It's been a week, that's for sure. All right, so we have House File 1623 in front of us. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you,
Chair.
And I think this goes back to Ways and Means, is that correct?
No.
You refer, hopefully as amended to Ways and Means, with a recommendation to the General Register.
Yeah. Well, again, members, thank you. We heard this bill a couple weeks ago, and I apologize. Again, the very good work from our staff indicated that there were several sections that would have required this bill to go to multiple committees. We're not aware of that until a couple of days ago. So rather than sacrifice all of the other sections, we at least want to delete several sections of this bill that would have had to go to other committees, and then repass the other items, and at least we will have some of the provisions most of the provisions that we've already passed moving forward. The Senate has passed a version of this. Not a number of our provisions are not in their bill, so it will go to conference committee, and we'll work from there on that. So members, if you have a section in here that has been deleted, with the exception of Section 64, which did generate some controversy when we heard it, we will figure something else out. Representative Kosnick, I just wanted to reassure you that, the data sharing wasn't here, and that would have had to go to Judiciary, for example. So we will schedule a hearing, and we will address the issue of Lakeville and the data sharing piece and the finance bill. And it's possible the finance bill might have to go to Judiciary. I don't know, but, very committed to that provision and, all of the other ones here. So I wanted to give you that was one of the sections that the staff flagged. Again, it was in the bill last year, and so are there any questions?
Mr. Chair, would you like to move your A3 amendment?
Yes. So that is the amendment. I don't know, members, would if you would like, Mr. Burris could go through this. Otherwise, it's pretty self-explanatory.
Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, I think at least a brief run through of what's being taken out of the bill would be appropriate. We all seem to be kind of searching through it to see what's not there or not going to be there anyway, so why don't we do it as a committee, and then we'll all be on the same page.
And Mr. Chair, I do believe there was a handout that I didn't hand it out, but it may be somewhere. Mr. Howe has it, and you can follow along here. With Mr. Burris. Follow along with Mr. Burris. You can proceed. Oh, you're the chair. I always forget when he's.
Let's wait until everyone has it in front of them here. Do we want? Never mind. We'll wait. Sorry. Thank you. All right, Mr. Burris, if you could please run through the sections that have been removed with the A3 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, the sheet being passed out is a cross-reference that highlights the. Provisions from the 2018 legislation, what the files and authors were, and it highlights the sections that would be removed with the proposed A3 amendment. The first of those is two different Met Council reporting provisions. One regards the reporting frequency of a OLA review of Met Council financials. And the other is a budget variance reporting that the Met Council would provide to the legislature. Both those sections would be removed. And then there are a set of sections that provide authority between the Met Council and Department of Human Services to share data. And this would be in conjunction with the Metro Mobility Program. Then the next set of sections being reviewed, and this is interspersed in the A3 amendment, by the way, a variety of sections kind of jumping back and forth across these provisions. So I'm just going from the standpoint of the provisions that would be coming out under the amendment. The next set relate to bicycle traffic regulations. These are substantially similar to another bill that had been heard and moved out of committee independently. And then there are several sections establishing a new driver and vehicle services fund that would be removed under the amendment. And then finally, there are some sections relating to driver's license suspensions, limiting the scenarios under which somebody's license could be resuspended. That, Mr. Chair, is kind of the quick overview of the amendment. I'm happy to go into further detail on questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Burris. Questions? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the right-hand side, that column, it doesn't seem – I'm not following it. It doesn't – you're saying the ones you read are going to be removed? I mean, I'll just look at the ZERWAS one down here. Driver's license suspensions, you mentioned okay, so that says removed, and it will be removed.
Correct? Representative Runbeck, that's comparing it to the Senate file. Senate file 1749.
Okay. Which means...
I think... Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you. So the section numbers that are listed on the left-hand column of the page, do they refer to the sections in 1623?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes. So the leftmost column are the section numbers in 1623.
For instance, it seems on the very first line that section 464 is included, yet on line 1.14 it says delete section 64.
I think they're still misunderstanding that.
Mr. Chair and members, so the leftmost column refers to the sections in 1623. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
The rightmost column that has the included and removed, that's only a discussion or preliminary review of activity in the Senate file, which is the companion to 1623. So it doesn't reflect anything with the amendment. What the amendment is impacting are just the highlighted rows. So the text of removed and included refers to the first engrossment of the Senate file and whether these provision, what the status is of these provisions in the Senate file kind of currently.
So to be clear, the highlighted rows on this sheet, so the darker rows here, are the ones that are being removed via A3 amendment?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Everybody with us?
Chair.
So thank you. And just,
Representative Mr.
Chair, so it's hard to reference what's in the Senate bill or not, I guess, compared to this, even this bill after it's amended.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, it is somewhat hard because this wasn't structured or designed purely as a comparison of the House file and the Senate file. It was really highlighting the A3 amendment with a little bit of here's the latest and greatest with the Senate kind of added in as a bonus. Sorry for the confusion on that additional column.
Mr. Chair, I take some responsibility for that because I was curious as to if the Senate had some of these removed provisions, then that might give some members at least some comfort that, you know, this would at least be in the conference committee. But, that was just not necessary for the discussion tonight, so I apologize for the confusion. And Mr. Chair, if I may.
Please, sir.
I did want to just note that you know, there was a little bit of discussion of a couple of provisions related to the Met Council and our and reporting on the budget in our last meeting. And based on the testimony, you know, again, we want to keep this as sort of a non-controversial bill. I did want to keep one of Representative Runbeck's provisions related to the legislative auditor's reporting, but I was uncomfortable with Section 64, which had quarterly reporting. So I, and Representative Runbeck, we can talk about this, but I, you know, that wasn't necessarily part of the procedural issue in this amendment, but it is my preference to remove that. So I wanted to, you know, let the committee know that Section 64 is removed, and I we can discuss that and debate it, but that is part of my motion.
Mr. Chair, yep. So, but that still, it doesn't, here on the sheet, they're treated the same. Yeah. You're saying they're going to be treated differently.
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, so. I mean, just, I wanted to just parse out the fact that that is not necessarily being removed because of a procedural issue that the staff has identified. It is the author's preference to remove that one section. So, you know, in the interest of transparency and
that was very kind of you. Yeah. Representative O'Driscoll.
So I don't mean to complicate this, but if I look at the Senate file 1749, the delete everything, if I were to say the word include means the same language in both the House and the Senate file, remove means not included in the Senate file but is included in the House file, would I be safe with that as the...
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I would not state it that strong because I only had an opportunity to take a very brief scan through the Senate file language, and so I haven't done a careful comparison of whether there are any changes within it. From a brief scan, it substantively covers the same topic and looks to be very similar, if not identical, but I don't know that it means it's identical at this point.
Thank you. So, Mr. Burris, is what you're saying is that a skinny omnibus is now a skinnier omnibus?
Mr. Chair, yes, it would be getting skinnier with the A3 amendment.
Yeah. Got it. Further questions? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A status question. What is the current status of the Senate file?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson. I believe that bill has cleared the Senate Transportation Committee, and it's in the Finance Committee there.
So there's still a possibility that the Senate file could change some more before it heads for the Senate floor.
Correct, as could ours.
As could ours. You know, there's a lot of provisions in this bill, some of which we're more interested in than others.
Yes.
It's just sooner or later, we will get some clarity,
yeah.
I guess. And, of course, you have the votes to pass this out of here, which in whatever shape you want to pass it out tonight, Mr. Chair. But it's a little bit confusing.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, I would agree with you. And, you know, it's just an unfortunate situation that, you know, some of these provisions, you know, could have, should have, right, gone to other committees, and it was sitting in Ways and Means. And fortunately, the staff was able to flag this. So at least we have something moving forward. And I certainly would be willing to collaborate with the ranking member and the Senate, and to see, you know, procedurally if it is possible to, you know, include some of these provisions. If not, then we can't. But you know, it is going to conference, and you know, we'll take it from there. And again, members, Mr. Chair, you know, the goal of this was to try to move some things that were vetoed last year that are important provisions. And, you know, that was simply the goal, to create a bill that wasn't controversial and that would move things along. And, you know, unfortunately, we just got caught up in some process here. So,
Representative Torkelson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the The author has answered my last question, and that was whether or not this was headed for conference, and we all know anything can happen in conference.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I have a question for you, and I probably should have asked you this sooner. But I just wanted, first of all, I want to clarify in this chart, my provision, House File 3920, I should say our provision, is 3925, is this for 2018. In 2019, it's House File 462, not 8. I just wanted to make that correction. Because I was looking it up to seeing how it's moving along in the Senate. So, and it hasn't moved out of, it's sitting in Transportation Finance and Policy Committee. So just to educate me on how this works in the future, if it doesn't get through their committee and it doesn't get in the omnibus bill, am I out of luck then, Mr. Chair? How does that work? So I'm just asking that question.
Good, Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, I would defer to Mr. Burris. I know your bill did pass off the House floor, so you know that's helpful. There may be some ways to, make sure it's included in other legislation. But Mr. Burris, do you have a thought about Representative Bernardi's question?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi.
Oh, okay.
Yes, so there's a mistake in the cross-reference sheet. That should be House File 462, not 468, as you pointed out. That has made it through the House. So, the language is still alive in the sense of it having been sent over to the Senate.
Representative Bernardi.
I'll get a tutoring of this afterwards. I just want to keep it alive as much as possible and as many avenues as possible, just because I don't want it to die. So I will find out after this committee.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bernardi, relative to the other 2,400 bills that have been introduced this session so far, I think you're in pretty good shape.
All right, so, Mr. Chair, do you have any further questions, or is there anyone who has further discussion on the we need to do the A3 amendment? So a motion has been made on the A3 amendment. Any further discussion on that? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. All right, now we've got 1623 as amended here. So, Mr. Chair, would you like to move... renew your motion?
Yeah, members, and thank you for your indulgence here. Again, this just started as a project to make sure that members' provisions that were vetoed would move along, and I think we're partially successful so far, and I hope we'll be wholly successful by the end of session. So I would ask for your support.
Any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? All right, motion prevails. Thank you. So we have 1623. Mr. Chair, do you have any announcements?
Yeah, so members, I guess, it's I always view the first deadline as sort of halftime in the session, and I do really want to especially thank the staff. We have had a lot of work done in this committee so far. We had major bills pass through here. So far, we had hands-free. We had two, and I think we're going to have a third deputy registrar bill and coming through here. We had Minlars come through here, which was the first bill signed into law of the entire session. We had an immigration bill. A lot of other bills, and now we're heading into the next round, which is our finance bills. So, at this halfway mark, I do want to thank all the members from both sides of the aisle. I think we've had some vigorous discussions and debates, but they've always been done in the spirit of friendliness and civility, which has characterized this committee. So We will have even more vigorous debates in the next few weeks and even more civility. So I appreciate everybody's participation so far, and thank you, Representative Torkelson, for ensuring that everybody can not at least do transportation tomorrow. So with that, my comments are done, Mr. Chair, and
sorry, I wasn't.
You're still in charge. You're still the chair.
Oh, I figured that you had taken it back from over there.
I don't have the gavel. So.
I lost interest. I would
advise, Mr. Chair, a motion to adjourn. I would advise a motion to adjourn.
All right. We are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.